soon, we're going to be joined by Helmut Harry Lowen, who is a lecturer at the University of Winnipeg, who teaches First Nations studies and race relations. And he's also been a longtime anti-racist activist who currently sits on the board of the Canadian Anti-Racism Education and Research Society. But first, while we try to get him on the phone, I'd like to welcome our dear news director, Kristen Schwartz, who is in the studio with us today. Hi, Kristen.
Thanks for having me on tonight, Darshani.
Oh, thanks for coming on.
So we're going to talk about the life and record of Wolfgang Droege. He was found dead by police in his apartment, or in the hallway, I think, of his apartment. And according to all the reports, it looks like his murder wasn't connected with the organized racist movement, except in the sense that his whole life was connected to the organized racist movement. So do we have Harry on the line?
Yes, we do.
Oh, thanks for joining us so much, Harry.
So, Harry, I guess the first thing we want to start with is that Wolfgang Droege has been involved in the far right for years, starting with the Western Guards in the 70s, and then the KKK, and then the Heritage Front in Toronto. So what activities have these organizations been involved in, both locally and nationally?
Well, Droege, you're right in pointing out, has a long history of racist activism with a whole range of groups, starting in the 1970s with, as you say, the Western Guard and the Canadian Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. He was a very good organizer, had good connections with the, you know, figurehead leaders like David Duke in the United States, the former Grand Wizard of the KKK. And in fact, in part because of Droege's connections with people like David Duke, the Ku Klux Klan was able to set up a number of chapters in the late 70s in Canada, thus rejuvenating the KKK movement, which had been fairly dormant since the 1920s and 30s in Canada.
Wow.
So Droege was, you know, at the forefront of literally the most significant racist and fascist organizing in Canada for, some 35 years or so. He was a major player. Of late, as you mentioned, he had been head of the Heritage Front, and then over the last number of years, he had ostensibly either stepped down as leader of the Heritage Front, or more likely was asked to step down to make room for Mark Lemire, who hasn't turned out to be all that good a choice at any rate. But with the, if not demise, then at least the weakening of the Heritage Front, in great part due to the work of anti-racist activists in Ontario and also the government's informancy inside the organization. When the Heritage Front went down, in many ways, that was, if not the end of his activism for racism, he wasn't, at least in the last number of years, in a significant position of leadership. But the press is wrong. Much of the press is sort of, you know, saying that Droege sort of disappeared from the limelight, but in fact he was still very active in terms of supporting Ernst Zundel, who was recently deported to Germany, and other figures within the white supremacist movement. But clearly with his death, with his early demise, while the murder itself may not be necessarily connected with organized racism, as Kristen pointed out at the outset, clearly, he had worked within these dark networks for so many years, and it really didn't surprise me that the chickens came home to roost last week when he was murdered in what may appear to be a love triangle, possibly with a woman who was involved with white supremacy for many years as well.
Kristen, do you have anything to add to?
Just that one of the dubious skills that I think Droege brought to his work was he seemed to be able to work with a lot of different kinds of people, so that's what made the Heritage Front more scary than some of the other groups that had come before.
Yes.
You know, so there were everything from, you know, people, military people, to the school teacher, Paul Frohm, who's since been fired and lost his position because of his involvement with the white supremacist movement, to Ernst Zundel, who is connected to a whole network of war criminals, Nazi war criminals, and Holocaust deniers internationally, and then at the beginning, Droga also could appeal to the younger set, you know, like the people that are involved with organizing racist rock concerts and that sort of thing. Though he did lose that credibility to a certain extent, because one thing that happened was that the Canadian Security Intelligence Service planted an agent within the Heritage Front right from the beginning. And this guy ended up taking on pretty serious roles in the organization. And when he was outed, it kind of discredited a lot of the leadership. You know, like the younger people weren't really going to trust Droga or any of the other old heads who had, like, been in bed with this CSIS agent all that, all those years, right?
Okay.
So that kind of faded away. But at the beginning, he was good at bringing all those, all the different players together, you know, and with, of course, the involvement in a certain way of the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, who paid this agent to be an organizer within the Heritage Front for 4 years or something like that.
4 years?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a long time to be paid.
His name was Grant Bristow.
Yes.
And I mean, I don't know to what extent it's true, but I remember one of the Heritage Front people afterwards saying that they'd gotten a grant from the government, and
what?
That would be Grant Bristow.
That's right.
I'm sorry. That's too funny. Grant.
Prison, $300,000 later, at least, yeah. Well over a quarter million went into that. And but, Kristen, you're absolutely right in saying that Droga was skillful at bringing together the various factions. You know, the neo-Nazi skinheads, the old KKK groups, the Church of the Creator, as it was known then, the Holocaust deniers, some of the so-called ethnic fascists from the, you know, Hungarian, Latvian, German communities, and so on. He was very good at bringing these different groups together under one coalition or one front. And so the Heritage Front was, as you know well in Toronto, was unique not only in terms of its scope. You know, it could attract 200 and 300 people to openly racist meetings, which really no group had been able to do before the Heritage Front.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a fairly large and significant organization, but at the same time it was unique because it brought together the various factions under the umbrella of the Heritage Front. And thirdly, as you point out, his ability to attract youth, including the white power racist rock scene, as a recruitment tool, that too was influenced very much by Droga. So he was a bit of a strategist on the one hand, while at the same time he was also just a down-and-dirty street thug and one of the toughest out there, mm-hmm. as some of his criminal charges indicated.
Yeah, but talking about bringing all kinds of people together, I read in the newspaper that Droga was invited by Muammar Gaddafi,
yes.
back in 1989 to attend the 20th anniversary party of the coup in Libya.
Right.
How did he get... Okay, when? Why is he going to Africa to party with Muammar Gaddafi? And, like, why was he invited to this party? Like,
Gaddafi has disavowed that policy. You know, within the last couple of years, Gaddafi has been accepted by world leaders. He has renounced terrorism, has engaged in some compensation. But back in the 80s, he had a strategy of which he called a kind of a third positionism. He would use political groups, both on the left and on the far right in this case, as part of a campaign of what he would call a campaign to destabilize the West. So mm-hmm. any dissident, extremist political organization, such as the white supremacists who would become the Heritage Front, some of that campaign was supported, not with massive amounts of money, but with some money from Libya. The Canadian writer Warren Kinsella, in his first book, which is called Unholy Alliances, looks at what he calls the Libyan connection in terms of sponsoring Canadian racist and terrorist organizations in the 1980s. So Gaddafi, on this occasion, invited the Heritage, or what would become the Heritage Front, and you had some 15 or 20 people from mainly southern Ontario, people like mm-hmm. Wolfgang Droga, Grant Bristow, who turned out to be the CSIS mole, mm-hmm. Nicola Polonuk, whose name has come up in this murder now, and a number of others, went to the so-called peace camp in Tripoli, and that's where the idea for organizing this new style racist coalition was essentially hatched in Libya. But
wow.
Many people, you know, wonder, you know, what was Gaddafi's plan in that case, but it was an attempt to use domestic groups like the Nationalist Party back then, which became part of which became the Heritage Front, as a kind of destabilizing campaign as well.
Now, I want to note, though, that, you know, there were people on the left who also attended those conferences.
That's right.
And were very surprised when they got there to find themselves alongside fascists.
That's right.
You know, so I talked with one woman, for example. She was a reproductive freedom an advocate and feminist from the Canadian West, and she went out to one of these gatherings in Libya.
Yes.
And she talked about when the left-wing people realized that there were all these fascists there, they went to the Libyan authorities and said, you know, you've got to do something to separate us, or, you know, you've got to get rid of these people. They shouldn't be at this revolutionary gathering, you know. Mm. And the way the Libyans dealt with it is they put all the Nazis on this ship and docked in the harbor, and that became their hotel. So, I mean, this is just a story that I heard, so I wouldn't, you know, 100% vouch for its authenticity, but okay. That's definitely what I was told. That
I've heard stories like that as well. Yes.
Yeah, but it's weird that they would actually go. You know, they're against people of color.
Yes.
And they go to the a party. Anyways, I guess we should move from there, because apparently in 1981, our Wolfgang Droga was convicted for an attempted coup of the Caribbean island of Grenada or Dominica?
Dominica, yes.
Dominica?
Yeah.
Yes, the conspirators, and it was actually a conspiracy to invade the island of Dominica, but initially the plan was to take over Grenada, and when it was discovered by people like Don Andrews in Toronto that that wouldn't be feasible, they decided on Dominica. And to make a very long story short, they took about 2 years of planning. From 79 to 81, Wolfgang Droga was involved at that time in collecting money from the United States, collected a few $100,000. I forget the exact amount, but it was significant money in order to finance this operation in terms of getting a ship, getting weapons, and so on. And they had some political allies on the island of Dominica, a former prime minister who wanted to get back into power. And so that former prime minister made a kind of a deal with the devil, with these KKK Nazis, saying, okay, if I assist you with this invasion of Dominica, you have to guarantee that I become prime minister again. They sort of agreed to that. But their plan was, among other things, to use that as a kind of a base of operations for major drug operations, partly then to fund the neo-Nazi movement in North America. And so after about 2 years, the FBI caught wind of that plot, and, you know, shortly before they were going to set sail from New Orleans in order to put this plan into action, there was some kind of joint task force, including the FBI, which arrested Droga, Don Black from the KKK, and others. And he was given actually a fairly light sentence, served only, in that case, about 3 years. Later, Droga returned to the States and was then given a longer sentence for cocaine dealing, which there are still rumors in Toronto that he was involved in that to his dying days, as it were. But that Dominica plot is a very interesting and, again, a very curious development in the story of Wolfgang Droga. We know, for example, that, you know, that coup back in the early 80s to invade Dominica, that the mafia was involved in that. There were at least two players from, I think it was the New Orleans mob, who were involved in some of the funding of that activity. So Droga had connections to a whole number of criminal networks, racist networks, but also to some of these organized crime networks.
Okay, so at one point, Droga decided that the way to doing racist work would be to become a politician. And he was quoted in saying that the way to go is politics. We can influence people, and we do not get thrown into jail. What does that say about Canadian politics?
Well, that's a very interesting point, because you're right. Droga did seek office. He received something like 13 or 14% of the vote in his ward running on an openly racist platform. So that 13 or 14% voter support says something about the extent of racism, at least in that part of Toronto. But it's not insignificant that he would get that kind of a vote on an openly racist platform. Mm-hmm. We also know, and this has come out in a number of documents, that Droga and Paul Fromm and some of the other Toronto-based white supremacists were members of what was then called the Reform Party, which then became the Alliance and then the Conservative Party. And it was only because of a lot of pressure, again, from anti-racists and from the press, that the leader at that time, Preston Manning, then decided to rescind the membership of people like Droege and others. Mm-hmm. But Droege and some of the members of the Heritage Front even provided bodyguard security services for Preston Manning when he spoke in Toronto and so on.
Wow.
So what that says to me is that the Reform Party was drawn to the Heritage Front was drawn to the Reform Party as a possible platform in order to deepen the intolerance and some of the bigoted policies that the Reform Party has with this influence from the even more extreme right wing. So this crossover between the so-called far right and the so-called moderate right, in some cases, there's really not much of a difference in terms of their rhetoric. Mm-hmm. Had the Reform Party and the Alliance Party talking about, you know, we will give no special rights to any group based on race, religion, and color.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds fine from one perspective, but essentially it was aimed at the so-called special rights which Native people have in this country, which actually aren't special rights. But the Reform Party, very much like the Heritage Front, was using this, you know, discourse of equality to promote an agenda of inequality, is how I like to put it usually.
Wow.
So what that says about the Canadian political system is that the political system is quite vulnerable, actually, to this kind of infiltration from the racist right wing, which, you know, spent much of the 1990s trying to establish sort of a beachhead within mainstream conservative political movements. We know, for example, that Leon Benoit, who is still a sitting member of the Conservative Party, a sitting member of parliament, a number of years ago he made statements when he was with the Canadian Alliance saying that, yes, he had met with Paul Fromm. Paul Fromm, who now views himself as sort of the leader of this movement in Canada. And Benoit, who is a sitting elected member, was open in admitting that he went to Paul Fromm, he sought Fromm out in order to get his views on immigration, and Benoit then concluded by saying he actually had some very good ideas that we might be able to implement. Now, what's a member of parliament doing interviewing a Toronto school teacher who was fired because of his white supremacist associations?
Yeah, that's kind of scary.
No.
It's very scary.
I wanted to ask you, Harry, what are some of the key strategies that were used to bring down the Heritage Front? Because the campaign to end the Heritage Front's influence directly was successful.
Well, although I'm based in Winnipeg, I followed very closely the events in the 1990s when ARA, Anti-Racist Action, was formed. And in my view to this day, what ARA did in Toronto and especially Southern Ontario, and then the networks which ARA built and established, is really singular in terms of how anti-racist activism should proceed. ARA, as you know, worked on many levels. There would be direct actions of different kinds. There would be actions to make the streets unwelcome for neo-Nazis who would, let's say, openly want to wear swastikas and that sort of thing. I mean, there was a point early in ARA's campaign when you couldn't go downtown in Toronto and openly sort of declare your allegiance to the Nazi movement with swastikas and so on. It simply became sort of a no-Nazi zone in Toronto due to very concerted direct action. Mm-hmm. Secondly, ARA was very good at setting up educational programs, public education campaigns,
mm-hmm.
Really good newsletters on the prowl, very good sources of information. ARA was able to infiltrate parts of this movement to get information from the inside. It's really exemplary what was done by Anti-Racist Action. And as someone who was invited, kindly invited by ARA to speak in the mid-90s at a Youth Against Hate conference, which itself was a marvelous event, the first gathering of its kind that I can recall, which brought together anti-racist activists from across North America with the purpose of building a network. So Anti-Racist Action, a lot of credit needs to be given to ARA, and I think the sign of the effectiveness of ARA is that the neo-Nazis in Canada are still complaining about ARA, you know, are still saying, are trying to besmirch the reputation of ARA by calling ARA a bunch of terrorists and this and that and so on. The Heritage Front and its allies were badly, badly stung by the different campaigns that ARA had, and we still have a lot to learn from how ARA organized on a whole different number of levels, both public and also in more covert fashions in terms of getting information, in terms of having informants in these various networks. It's really marvelous what ARA did back then.
Cool. I just wanted to acknowledge the importance of the work of Rodney Bobbywash, who was one of the people who encouraged the folks to form ARA. He worked at the Native Canadian Center and set up a group, Clan Busters, before ARA existed, and worked with the Canadian Alliance in Solidarity with Native People. And they were the first people to do pickets outside of meetings of the Heritage Front before the youth came on board, you know. Rodney Bobbywash also brought the complaints to the Canadian Human Rights Commission that resulted in charges and hearings and so on that brought the Nazis out and made what they were doing more visible to the general public, which otherwise wouldn't necessarily have known unless they had the misfortune of running into them.
Okay. And the price that Rodney Bobbywash paid, and I pay great tribute to him as well, he's now deceased, and that's a great loss for the human rights movement in Canada, but you're right, he was the very first, almost single-handedly, to make that issue known, and the price he paid in terms of threats and campaigns against them, it's really quite remarkable how he got all of that going in Toronto very early on.
So we're going to go to a quick break, and Harry, we got some more questions for you about what's happening in the West. So don't leave us, but we're just going to listen to some of Chumbawamba's Enough is Enough,
a classic
anti-fascist track. This is Word of Mouth News on CKLN 88.1 FM. This is Word of Mouth News on CKLN 88.1 FM. We are speaking right now with Helmut Harry Lowen, of the University of Winnipeg and the Canadian Anti-Racism Education and Research Society. Harry, you've been active in Winnipeg on issues related to the extreme right and race relations in general for a number of years, and I wonder if you can just give us an outline of some of the significant things that have been happening in that area in the last year.
Within the last year or so, yeah, in Winnipeg, the attempt was made last year to set up a so-called white rights group. The group was called Western Canada for Us, WCFU. The Winnipeg chapter was inaugurated by a courier driver in his mid-20s, young white guy by the name of Jamie Murphy, and he had been appointed by Glenn Barr from Edmonton, who had started up the main chapter of Western Canada for Us. Barr had instructed Murphy to get something going in Winnipeg, so they tried to get something started, and almost a year ago this week, Murphy, after doing a lot of plugging of the organization on the internet and so on Stormfront and various other websites, he announced a meeting at the big city park here in Winnipeg, Assiniboine Park, a kind of a recruitment meeting. And I'm glad to report the meeting was a bust, because aside from one supporter of his, what you had happened that day was about just two dozen, a small group of anti-racist activists, including some of the old ARA people, United Against Racism people, and some of the new anarchist groups, basically came to the park and confronted Murphy, called him on his racism, even though he had tried to code his message as, you know, I'm not a racist, I just want to protect white rights. Again, very similar to the kind of rhetoric that Wolfgang Droege introduced. Well, there was also a massive police presence there, undercover and so on, and eventually they had to take Murphy home under police escort, because he was outnumbered by, you know, again, a fairly small group of anti-racist activists who made it very clear that this wasn't going to fly in Winnipeg. So the Winnipeg chapter was folded very, very quickly after that. But the Edmonton chapter kept pursuing its activities. And shortly after that last year, Glenn Barr, the Edmonton organizer for WCFU, was arrested. Computer seized, and he now faces charges, or he, at least he's under criminal investigation in Edmonton for violation of Canada's hate propaganda laws. And that's going to be one of the most significant hate propaganda cases we've had in Canada in a number of years, in part because it involves testing the legislation around the internet dissemination of hate. So it's something we'll watch for, and we'll see who is his lawyer in that case. In terms of other cases, we've had some curious and very sad developments. You'll remember the case of David Ahenicu, the Saskatchewan Native leader who was charged under the hate crime laws. That case has now concluded in Saskatoon. Now, Ahenicu, who made statements about how Hitler was justified in the Nazi genocide and so on, was charged under, again, the hate propaganda legislation. What was interesting is that Ahenicu's lawyer was Doug Christie, who has defended most of the major neo-Nazi and other racist defendants in Canada, including the Manitoba Knights, the Ku Klux Klan, an organization that we fought here in the late 80s, early 1990s. So the judge will rule on the Ahenicu case in June, but it's very interesting that Christie has put his hat back into the ring and is defending people on hate crime charges. He has another case in Vancouver right now which involves a convicted Nazi war criminal, an elderly German-Canadian, Michael Seifert, who has already been convicted of murder in an Italian court in Bolzano, Italy, for crimes that he committed during the Second World War, and Christie is trying to prevent that deportation. Christie was also involved at various times with Ernst Zundel and so on and so forth. Well, Christie is interesting because, aside from defending these so-called unpopular causes, as he likes to call them, he's also a bit of a politician. For many years, since the 70s, in fact, he's had a group called Western Canada Concept, which promotes independence for the four Western Canadian provinces. Now, that group, Western Canada Concept, has undergone a change, and it's now called the Western Bloc Party. But it is still promoting the same agenda for Western Canadian separatism. And Christie, of late, literally within the last few weeks, has been very active in the British Columbia interior and in Alberta, in public meetings trying to promote this Western independence notion. Now, what's interesting in this case, and interesting in connection with his defense of Ahenikyu, is that Christie is really no friend of Canada's native peoples. If one looks at what Christie has written about Aboriginal rights, about treaty rights and so on, he has said explicitly that a government following the principles that he has established would not recognize treaty rights, would rescind the existing rights, and would actually look at, you know, questions around citizenship. Who would actually qualify as a citizen in this new fictional Western independent Canada? So that's something to watch. That's something that we're monitoring here fairly closely, because on the one hand, there is no explicitly racist agenda that Christie's Western Bloc Party is promoting. But if one knows Christie's position, if one has studied him very closely, again, not unlike Wolfgang Droege and the Heritage Front, they use sort of coded language to promote what is literally an agenda of intolerance, of bigotry, and of denying people, in this case Aboriginal people, their constitutional rights. And so we're looking at that very closely. Finally, we have the stirrings here in Manitoba of a new white power organization, and that too is under criminal investigation, both in the city of Winnipeg and in western Manitoba in Brandon. And the little bit that I can tell you about it is that this too will promise to be, I think, a very significant case, given the virulent racism and Nazism that these people are promoting in these two cities. Now, that's something new. We haven't had that type of explicit white supremacist skinhead activity, at least not in any organized fashion, for a few years in Manitoba. I mean, the anti-racists here, again, did a very good job through direct action and by using the human rights complaints, which we used against the Klan and so on, in terms of shutting these organizations down. And we're hoping that with this new group that's emerged here, and which is really only known among white supremacist circles, that this group will be quashed about as quickly as it emerged.
Just to conclude, to wrap up this interview, Harry, I wanted to ask you, a lot of times people will say systemic racism, the race discrimination in employment, racial profiling by police or immigration services, just the connection between poverty and racism, that these issues are obviously so much more important and so much more devastating in a sort of systemic everyday level for people who are on the receiving end, people of color and Aboriginal people or First Nations people. And so what's the importance of doing work around the far right? How do you see it as related?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, I hear that quite, I've heard that for many, many years, that, you know, why are you guys chasing, you know, skinheads or Klansmen and so on, when the real problem is institutional racism? My position has been that it's not a question of one or the other. I mean, we know now from, you know, some of the social science research that's been done on hate groups that these groups can't flourish unless they operate in an enabling environment. And that enabling context is the institutional racism, the legacy, and the history of deep and profound racism that we have in Canada. All of that ties in, facilitates, and even enables some of these more extreme or seemingly extreme and violent expressions. So it's not a question of one or the other. And so I try to point out, and, you know, a scholar at the University of Saskatchewan, Peter S. Lee, has written a paper on racial supremacy in a social democratic society, and he makes that point. He says that the institutional racism and the extent to which Canada has been, for much of its history, a racial state, if you will, that needs to be examined in order to explain why hate groups flourished to the extent that they have flourished in this country since the 19th century, actually. So that's one way of answering the question. But I think the simplest way of answering the question, why fight hate groups, is that there are actually very few people who do that, right? Historically, the anti-hate type of activist, the people who track and monitor hate group activity, these have been fairly small organizations, or in some cases even just sort of independent activists who aren't tied in with an anti-racist group, who have studied these organizations and then who pursue them through research, through human rights complaints. Look at someone like Richard Warman, the Ottawa lawyer, who has filed numerous human rights complaints in terms of shutting down recently a number of racist organizations, and he's, you know, used lawsuits against Paul Fromm and so on and so forth. So while there are organizations, and in some cases well-funded organizations, that conduct and advocate around institutional racism, the support for the anti-hate type of activism is almost minimal in this country. We have almost no money that's being used federally or provincially to support groups like the groups that were active in Toronto, Anti-Racist Action, or my group in Vancouver. We've had our budgets cut to the point where our executive director is barely working part-time right now. And so that is, I think, the response that needs to be given, that there are very few people who actually have specialized in this area, although I think that's beginning to change. We're beginning to see, for example, that even from an academic perspective, scholars in law faculties and sociology departments and so on, there's a new generation of scholars which is beginning to look at hate crime and hate groups from that perspective. And so I expect that some of that will get better in the future generation. But I'm actually saddened when I hear that, you know, to say, well, it's either one type of activism or the other. The two are very closely interconnected.
And I guess there's going to be different people fighting from each of those fronts, which is very important because we need everybody on board to fight.
We need unity on this, you know, in terms of the different kinds of activisms, and especially around human rights and anti-racism in the broadest sense of anti-racism.
Exactly. And all oppression, period, right? Because oppression, period, shouldn't be, it should be our goal to eliminate all that. Thank you very, very much, Harry, for joining us today and sharing your wealth of knowledge.
My pleasure. Thank you.